How ready is Texas when it comes to the spread of the coronavirus? We'll talk with the state representative leading a hearing on that very question today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. When it comes to coronavirus preparedness, how much does the high number of uninsured Texans complicate matters? Also, voting delays in Texas last week. Was Hillary Clinton right in laying the blame where she did? Madeline Meckelberg of The Statesman with a PolitiFact check. Plus, the school district shutdown that at the last moment didn't happen. We'll hear why, what happens next, plus a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, you're on Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday, March 11th, the day in which health officials are now reporting that coronavirus cases have surpassed the 1,000 mark nationwide. At last check, the New York Times reporting 30 cases in Texas. The Texas Legislative Committee that focuses on public health met with several experts yesterday to evaluate the state's response to the spread of the virus and what steps should be taken next. Joining us now, Texas State Representative Sinfronia Thompson, who chairs the Public Health Committee. Representative Thompson, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
It was a rather long hearing, about 5 hours, as I understand it. What do you make of what you heard in that hearing? Are you convinced that the state's doing all it can to deal with the spread?
I think the state is putting itself in a position to be able to address this issue as it pops up here, there, and everywhere. We want to be sure that all of the agencies were on ready. They had taken an assessment of the situation. Being able to look at the magnitude of what the problem is and may become.
Do you feel more assured or comfortable about the Texas approach to this or no?
Oh, I feel comfortable about that we're in a position of that we're going to be able to address the issue. We just hope it doesn't get severe.
Texas Health Commissioner John Hellerstedt said yesterday, Texas must show the world how this is done. He's talking about, of course, how you contain something like this. But It's very hard to try to contain the spread of a virus. It's extremely difficult. What do you see as the prime challenge right now for Texas?
First of all, we want to make sure that we're giving good information out. And second of all, that we have agencies and all of the facilities that address or work toward addressing these issues are aware of it. They are ready to work toward it and that they have supplies and things that they need to be able to work to assist our citizens. It appears as though that they keep coming back to say, you know, wash your hands. But, you know, there are some situations and there are some of our citizens who cannot wash their hands. And so they said, well, you know, those who can use gloves, you know, we use gloves and so forth and so on, you know. But the main thing is, in addition to that, we just don't get in crowds and things or get around persons that may have been exposed to it.
Sort of healthcare 101, I think, is one of the quotes that I heard from yesterday's hearing.
Everything seems to center around a healthcare 101. You know, staying safe, staying away from crowds, particularly persons that may have been exposed, and making sure that you do all that you can do to keep yourself healthy and safe, along with your family.
What about testing? I mean, are there enough test kits, enough laboratories able to address that aspect of the spread?
That was our main concern. And this is what they say. We don't want to just start testing people to see whether or not they have it or not, because we may get a false test. We wait until we see some signs of it. And if we see the signs of it, then we do those tests. He feels like presently we're in a good position with enough tests available, with new tests coming available to us, that if something was to break out, then we're in a good position that we can address it at this time.
I want to loop back and talk a little bit more about something you were mentioning, people who are vulnerable. Of course, we think of the elderly, but there's also, as epidemiologist Michael Osterholm has said, looking at what what has been discovered in China and in Italy. It appears that people who smoke and people who are obese are also at higher risk. And of course, in Texas, we have high levels of the uninsured. We have high numbers of obese people in Texas, too. Are we doing everything we can to address the needs of those people and the possibility of them being quite severely affected?
Well, we was concerned about when we were talking to him and others like yesterday, will our hospitals get overrun? And will they be overrun with people who are have no insurance? Of course, you know, if they come, you know, we're not going to turn them away. Now, they didn't stress too much about obesity yesterday, but they kept talking about the elderly and persons who have respiratory problems.
What do you think the state could do or should do when it comes to focusing its efforts at this point? I mean, if you were to make an advisory opinion to state leaders, what would you say?
Well, I would say that we should be ready with enough tests to address it if it got to be widely spread. We should have enough supplies on hand to address the sanitary need, and that we should keep the public well informed as to what to do if they're going to end up having to stay in for several days. But what do we tell them to put in their homes? And I asked Hellestat that yesterday. So he said, well, whatever they eat, they don't have to eat anything particularly, you know. But the main thing is to stay well hydrated.
We've been speaking with Texas State Representative Sinfronia Thompson, who's been representing the 141st District since 1972. She chairs the Legislative Public Health Committee. Had a rather lengthy hearing yesterday on the coronavirus. Representative Thompson, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
And thank you for letting me do it.
Let's get back to that uninsured population. Texas has the largest in the country, which could make it harder to contain the virus. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports experts say this also presents unique hurdles for a large part of the state's workforce.
Tiffany Connor is like a lot of Texans in that she has spent a good chunk of her life without health insurance. She says it's been an on and off thing.
You know, at one point you almost kind of get used to it. Like, I've been uninsured now for almost 2 years, but before I had my son, I was used to living in Texas without insurance.
Connor's also a single mom, so getting sick is a constant fear. She worries about who is going to take care of her 5-year-old boy or her mom, who is over 60. And lastly, she worries about who will take care of her. And news reports about a possible spread of the coronavirus in Texas have just amped up all those fears.
When you have something like this pandemic, it definitely heightens your awareness of being uninsured.
Connor's plan to deal with all this is to avoid getting sick in the first place, especially since her mother is at an age that makes her particularly vulnerable to the virus. She wishes she had access to a doctor, a primary care physician or PCP, or any medical professional that she can go to with concerns.
This is the time when it would be wonderful to have access to that type of expert, to be able to call my PCP and say, hey, like, what do I need to be doing here? How scared should I be? Or what should I be worried about? What precautions should I take? All I can do is go on the basis of what I'm reading online, you know?
And calling up a doctor with questions is something not a lot of uninsured people can do. Dr. Jewel Mullen, the Associate Dean for Health Equity at Dell Medical School, says that even though this is something public health officials are advising.
If we're telling people, don't just go to an emergency department or show up at the doctor's office, call your doctor. 50% of people who lack health insurance report that they don't have a usual source of care. There's no logical place for them to automatically call.
Dr. Mullen is also a PCP. She says a big part of her job is doing something she calls right-sizing concern. Basically, she helps patients run through a checklist that will help them figure out how at risk they are of getting sicker or getting someone else sick.
Think about how often people just want to call and say, do I need to come get a test for that? People who lack insurance don't have as much ease at just talking to someone to get peace of mind and reassurance about following good public health advice.
More than 5 million Texans don't have health insurance. The state has the highest uninsured rate and number in the country, and it's been getting worse recently. Ann Dunkelberg with the Center for Public Policy Priority says this population is raising a slew of concerns as the coronavirus spreads.
They're not quite as vulnerable as seniors and people with disabilities potentially, but but they do face a special round of challenges.
And this population happens to be very concentrated among the state's working poor. Dunkelberg says these are people who are mostly in the service industry, making on average less than $32,000 a year. She says about 40% of that population doesn't have health insurance, which again means they don't have easy access to a doctor.
Our folks who are out there in the retail and service trades practically and economically have a hard time trying to comply with, you know, the ideal behaviors that we're putting out there as what we want people to do during a disease outbreak.
Another piece of advice people in the service industry can't follow is staying at home if they feel sick. Jonathan Lewis, who also works at the Center for Public Policy Priorities, says about 78% of the state's service industry doesn't have sick time.
This is especially concerning because this is the industry that is working in restaurants, handling food, cooking food. These are folks that are working in nursing homes, that are taking care of elderly, that are potentially more at risk.
Dr. Jewel Mullen says the spread of the virus among the state's uninsured population could also put strains on safety net providers in Texas, like federally qualified health centers. She says ultimately she hopes all this forces people to take a look at the cost of the state's high uninsured rate.
Because for 20% of adults and more than 10% of children in Texas, that's a daily problem, only made worse at times like this.
And that's why Tiffany Connor hopes people also do what they can to avoid spreading the virus.
So if you care about the people in your life, especially people who don't have health insurance or access to medical care, take those tiny precautions. Do what you can to help make it better for them. It's kind of like the idea of herd immunity, right, with vaccines. It's not just about whether or not you feel sick or you feel threatened. Just remember, it's not just about you.
I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
All right, let's find out what Texans are talking about on social media. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Last night's primary elections in several states have folks talking, particularly about one big topic, Joe Biden's decisive win over Bernie Sanders in Michigan and what it means for Sanders' continued contesting of the primary. Alluding to what could be a likely presidential nomination for Biden, Meg Hertz writes, "It will be a great day for America when Bernie is invited to join the party in creating the platform at the convention." Via Facebook, she adds that Sanders was dismissed in 2016. That shouldn't happen again. Help people understand the process. Otherwise, they won't vote in November. Also on our Facebook page, Leah Keese says last night's results align with her thinking that after Trump, most people want a return to normalcy. They're not ready for a revolution. Well, that's just one topic we're keeping an eye on. We're also watching for the latest developments regarding Texans and the new coronavirus. I'll be back with more stories from social media later in the show.
That ain't, you know, feeling like a new coronavirus
anymore.
No,
sir, not anymore. You know, and I got to add, David, yesterday you were asking what impact this would have on people's travel plans.
Yeah, right.
We have some interesting responses to that.
Wow. I'm looking forward to hearing that. You know, we need to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar will be back in 35 with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
Hey there, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Even if you don't follow the commodity markets, if you live in Texas, it's hard to imagine you haven't heard concerns about plummeting oil prices. Great for drivers, awful for the Texas economy, if the drop lasts, that is. Fears about the coronavirus already having an impact. Then, Saudi Arabia and Russia got into a fight over production, and now both countries threatening to flood the market with inexpensive oil, which adds up to how much of a hit for Texas. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley went looking for some answers.
We know that the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Russia has caused oil prices to fall. According to University of Houston Energy Fellow Ed Herz, what we don't know is how long the dispute will last.
If it goes beyond 18 to 24 months, I think we'll see a number of bankruptcies with the smaller independents.
Adding to that uncertainty is the coronavirus. We know it's slowing down economic activity as events are canceled and travel restrictions are put in place. CERAWeek is a big oil and gas conference that was slated for this week in Houston, but canceled. And that's one of the things that concerns Assistant Business Law Professor Dietrich von Biedenfeld at University of Houston downtown. He says industry meetups are essential for the long-term health of the oil market. But at a Women in Energy luncheon he went to last week,
there were a number of empty seats. That means that people aren't networking, right? So that means that people that would be building relationships and developing the pipeline of future women leaders in energy and in the oil and gas industry were not participating.
Other events have been postponed because of coronavirus fears, and some slated for later in the spring, like the Offshore Technology Conference, say they're closely monitoring the situation. For many in the industry, though, the more immediate concern is how long prices will remain depressed. Again, here's von Biedenfeld.
We're seeing concerns that if oil does not increase beyond $50 a barrel soon, a lot of people will be laid off.
Layoffs that could hit Houston and also out in the oil fields of places like the Permian Basin in West Texas. I talked to Stephen Robertson with the Permian Basin Petroleum Association.
Any kind of impacts economically on the Permian Basin, anybody that I've talked to very much believes it'll be short-lived.
Robertson says, sure, some things have changed. It's been suggested that large group meetings happen on the internet instead, but most of the conversations he's heard have been less about economics and more about safety.
Obviously, it is having an impact on the international markets, which can have an impact on operations out here because we're always impacted when the price of WTI fluctuates either up or down. But really, so many of the conversations that I've heard people talking about are on the health side of things.
However, Ed Herz at UH says that if either the spread of the coronavirus or the price disputes last for a long time, it will especially hurt small and mid-sized oil producers in areas like the Permian Basin. But if the coronavirus acts like the seasonal flu and dissipates as we head into the spring, he thinks the economy will recover pretty quickly. But what about that dispute between Saudi Arabia and Russia? Herz says,
the Saudis have the ability to push this price war out 4, 5, 6 years, and even Russia has said they can go 4, 5, or 6 years with this. The U.S. shale plays can't exist that long at $40 oil, and so in 2 to 3 years, if the price war continues, it's going to be a very difficult time to be in the oil patch.
I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Most Texas jails offer little more information than the names and charges against those kept inside, but now the state's largest, Harris County, is putting a whole lot more information on the internet about who is locked up there. Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez is here with us to talk about a new online dashboard that allows the public to see in real time all the statistics about the nearly 9,000 people detained each day there, what types of crimes they're accused of, even how long they've stayed. Sheriff Gonzalez, welcome to the Texas Standard.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I want to be clear about something because I was a little confused about this until I saw it with my own two eyes. You're not putting up online the names and mugshots of people who are in your jail. This is really about another way to see raw aggregated data, right?
That's correct. There's no personal information. It's just different data sets that we're putting online just to give a snapshot of different things that we see every day in our jail.
Now, tell us a little bit about some of the data points that you're trying to track with this website.
Well, we're able to see risk factors, for example, in terms of what our population looks like, how many are deemed to be basically, you know, low-risk offenders, average length of stay, homeless population, what the breakdown is based on ethnicity, gender, those type of things. We want to give a snapshot of what we see every day. You know, in county jails all over the country, many times people don't understand what our population looks like, and they don't understand the vast majority are pre-trial, meaning that they've yet to be convicted. And so it's really an eye-opener once they get to see and understand. And for too long, data has been available in policing, but we haven't always been very transparent in letting the general public just know what we have to deal with every day. So we want to increase transparency.
I have to say that this is
pretty jaw-dropping. I mean, the how clear it is, the information. You have, for instance, a mental health indicator. You have sort of a color wheel, basically. You have a color wheel for homeless, self-reported. You have another one on that indicates how many of the inmates are currently on psychotropic medication. What I'm wondering about is, who is the audience for this? Are you trying to reach everyday folks in Harris County, or are you trying to reach people who are in charge of making policy?
Everyone, you know, hopefully the state legislature. Obviously, we operate in essence with the largest mental health facility in the state. And in my opinion, jails are not the best place to be dealing with that type of medical issue. That should be treated as a public health issue and as a criminal justice issue. So once we really see, and the taxpayer sees, that money could perhaps be better spent with boots on the ground, out on patrol, really going after serious offenders, then hopefully we could change some of the spending priorities in other parts of government as well. There's so much to glean from this. It's just, it's all new. So we just got to find the practical ways to apply it now in different settings, whether it be academic, you know, your community leaders that are interested just in what's going on in terms of trying to reduce reoffending.
Sheriff, let me interrupt you there and ask you, how hard was this to put together? Because there's a lot of information here. It's all shown graphically in a manner that makes it really kind of easy to absorb. And I'm wondering what sort of feedback you've received from your colleagues, because I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this.
Yeah, well, the feedback we've received has been very positive. You know, I think people, it's refreshing. It's good for them to know that, hey, you know, we're all in this together. These are complex issues. We're not making any kind of statement. It's basically information in real time, daily information that I, as a police executive, have to look and to make policy decisions and prioritize spending based on what I see every day.
It's definitely worth taking a look at, and we're going to have a link to it over at texasstandard.org. Ed Gonzalez is the sheriff of Harris County, and his office oversees the largest county jail in Texas. Sheriff Gonzalez, thanks so much for spending a couple of minutes with us to talk about this new online dashboard.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas health officials are confirming cases of coronavirus in new areas, bringing the total to more than 30 across the state. Dallas and Tarrant counties identified their first patients on Tuesday. A case has also showed up in Montgomery County in East Texas. The Houston area has seen the largest concentrations, with more than a dozen split between Harris and Fort Bend counties. Public health officials have anticipated new cases, but there's no evidence the illness is spreading through communities in Texas. All cases have been found in people who traveled abroad or their close contacts. Nearly 100 cruise ship passengers arrived at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio last night. Texas Public Radio's Lauren Terrazas reports a second plane load is expected to land later today.
Lackland Air Force Base could house up to 380 evacuees once the second cohort of cruise ship passengers arrives today. 98 passengers from the Grand Princess cruise ship arrived late Tuesday night, 91 of which are Texas natives, according to Governor Greg Abbott. The individuals will be quarantined on base for a two-week period and will be closely monitored to see if they develop any symptoms of COVID-19. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg told CNN this morning city health officials are working diligently to prevent the virus from reaching area residents. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz has a day left of self-quarantine in Houston due to his possible exposure to the coronavirus at a political conference last month in Maryland. The Texas Republican shook hands and possibly took a selfie with someone at the Conservative Political Action Conference who was later diagnosed. Cruz said on his podcast posted today that he chose to self-isolate even though federal health officials cleared him to go out in public.
Given the nature of the job that representing 28 million people in Texas, I am out, I'm seeing people, I am engaging with people frequently, that it made sense to be prudent. And since that time, have stayed at my house, self-quarantining for 14 days from the point of the incident. But I am feeling great and healthy and strong.
Cruz is one of several members of Congress staying away from others after coming in contact with the infected person. And Dallas County today is recounting ballots cast on Super Tuesday. County Elections Administrator Tony Pippins-Poole requested the recount after 44 thumb drives with uncounted votes turned up following the election. A state district court judge on Tuesday approved manually recounting the votes that had not been tallied. Officials from both parties say the recount is unlikely to change any election results. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron Adler Clough & Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Monday night was set to mark a dramatic moment in the history of Shepherd in southeast Texas, population almost 3,000. The state was about to take over the city's school district with a formal swearing in of a new board of managers. This after two schools had been receiving failing grades for years. But the night was about to get more dramatic still. The transfer of power would not happen as planned, and nearly everyone in the building was taken by surprise, as was Aaliyah Swaby, because she watched it all go down. She is the public education reporter for the Texas Tribune. Aaliyah, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Must have been pretty startling. The state was getting set to take over, and even the elected board appeared resigned to that fact. So why didn't it happen?
So the school board's lawyer, unbeknownst to some people on the school board, had continued pro bono with the lawsuit in state appeals court. And they, earlier that day, had asked the court to stop the state from seating the appointed board of managers that evening, and the court had agreed. And so they came down with a temporary order down from Austin, and everyone found out about it at about the same time as they walked into the district administration building to plan to see the appointed board seated.
Is it clear why these pro bono attorneys were still pressing forward with this case without the knowledge of members of the school board?
That's one of the biggest questions circulating around Shepherd the day after the meeting. There were some school board members who had absolutely no idea that this case was still live, had no idea that this court order could even come down. They thought that they had just pulled out of the case altogether, and there had been a vote where they decided not to move forward with it.
Well, this sounds like it was a little bit of a chaos and mayhem. What was the reaction?
There was a lot of confused silence. You know, you had members of the appointed board who are members of the community that the state has chosen to take over from the elected school board and run the board instead of them, standing alongside elected school board members who are about to essentially lose all their power.
Awkward.
Both of them wondering who was going to get to gavel in at the end of the night.
Oh boy.
And who was going to be in charge of Shepherd ISD moving forward for the next 2 to 5 years.
Now, I guess this meeting had been officially what? Called by the TEA, the Texas Education Agency?
Yes, the Texas Education Agency, you know, notified them that they would be swearing in the appointed board that evening. And so everyone was prepared for that. Mm-hmm. State education officials showed up and ended up having to confer with their lawyers for a while when they saw the order that had come down in Austin and decide what they were going to do next. Ultimately, they canceled the meeting.
wait a minute, who's in charge? I mean, if the court order says that the TEA can't swear in new board members, but there are no board names on the plates in the boardroom, then does anyone know who's running the schools in Shepherd Independent School District?
There's still a lot of confusion about that. I would think that the elected school board, you know, since they're the only ones who have been sworn in at all, would continue. But also, I don't think people are clear about that. The community is definitely not clear about that. The TEA also appointed a superintendent last week to replace the superintendent of Shepherd. They replaced it with him with a TEA official, Jason Hewitt. He was there as well. And when he left, everyone had questions about which man was leading the school district, which man was superintendent. That's also a question I haven't seen answered in any official capacity. I don't think people are clear about who's leading their school district.
Well, now, what about elected officials? Do they want to hang on to their jobs? It sounded like, from what you'd written, that they were sort of resigned to the fact that this was happening.
Well, there's a lot of anger among the elected school board that the state is coming in, that they're losing local control, that they were democratically elected, and now they will have to stand to the side while a state-appointed board makes all the decisions for the district. And, you know, we'll have to watch and see what happens in the Third Court of Appeals in Austin and see how this case moves forward. It's unclear as of now exactly what the ultimate result will be, you know, whether it'll end up with TEA being able to seat this appointed board or not. But there are definitely way more questions than answers right now in Shepherd.
Aaliyah Swaby continues to get to the bottom of this story, and what a fascinating one it is. It's all unfolding in San Jacinto County, where the school board of Shepherd, Texas, which was supposed to be replaced on Monday, was not. Read all about it over at texasstandard.org. We'll have a link to her piece. Aaliyah, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Screening can lead to early detection and is recommended for all men and women age 50 and older. More at texasoncology.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Pinewood Derby. Ring any bells? For years, young scouts have been building and racing toy cars made out of little slabs of wood. But for the past 20 years in Denton, young people in grades 6 through 12 have been building little race cars so charming you could almost eat them. Literally. KERA's Bill Zeeble explains.
In a crowded Texas Women's University auditorium, 4x4x12-inch vehicles are racing down a ramp.
Guys, ready? One, two, three. There it goes.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
2.52. That was actually...
Some take more than 60 seconds. The fastest this year clocked in at a second and a half. Welcome to TWU's 22nd Annual Edible Car Contest. They're made of everything from sausage, salt, and squash to this one of cucumbers and carrots. The four Argyle Middle School teammates explain the inspiration.
It's vegetarian,
and it looks like a toad.
Yeah, so it's like green like a toad, yes. And like we just made it off of an inside joke.
Ribbit. Like the frog. Ribbit.
Those are 7th graders Kennedy Carter, Maddie Majersic, Avery Sandifer, and Harley Vanig. Each car gets 2 runs. In the first heat, the cucumber lost a wheel. The second time, it sped down with only 3 in 2.5 seconds. Then it broke apart.
That's like the design, because the frog like jumps.
Yeah.
The frog
so,
like, jumps. Like it has like, to go jumps. Slow first, and then it like.
This is supposed to be fun. TWU math and computer science professor Don Edwards came up with it 22 years ago. He's now retired, but wouldn't miss this.
I think it's a great event. It gets students excited, and we teach them teamwork. When you're designing something, you have to follow the specifications, and then we hope we just. Showing them that there are things that you can do that are just fun, educational, and worth doing.
Like making a car that can double as dessert.
It's made of graham crackers, royal icing, salt wheels, spaghetti sticks, sugar, a wafer, Rice Krispie treats.
That's Tannehill 6th grader Ryan Duddington. Teammate Kiefer Stanley explains the inspiration.
We think
Well, I thought of Wreck-It Ralph, the movie, and there's a candy racing car.
Welcome to the bakery! Let's bake a car! You have 1 minute to win it.
Winning is a goal for these four student teams that must have at least two girls each. They vie for prizes based on speed, materials, creativity, durability. This Tannehill team took second place overall.
It's just really nice to know that you and your team's work has paid off.
The sixth graders include Jackson Westbrook, Macy Munoz, Inara Mahalitz, and Niraf Pokrol.
And Power Ideas actually was really good, and seeing our idea kind of come to life, it was it's really exciting.
The losers today have to eat the vegetarian vehicles. Winners eat the candy cars. Just kidding. Brandy Gallagher with TWU volunteered here for years before now running the edible car contest. She says no one wants to eat these.
They have been handled by multiple people. They've run down a ramp and on the floor. In 13 years, I've never seen a kid eat their car.
The kids did get some snacks, though. I'm Bill Zeeble in Denton.
A relatively new phenomenon in modern society is the rise of the influencer, a person on social media skilled at persuading followers to buy stuff. Critics make smug comments about Kylie Jenner and other celebrities seemingly famous for being famous, but the fact is, as Forbes recently noted, influencer is now a career option for those with certain talent sets. But Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong wondered how many of today's influencers will have as much influence over time as some of the accidental influencers of our past.
Many people think that Jim Bowie was made famous by defending the Alamo. He was, in truth, already quite famous nearly 10 years before he gave his life for Texas freedom. He was famous as a knife fighter, knife designer, frontiersman, and all-round world-class badass. He was truly a man's man by any standard. His world-renowned Bowie knife was probably first made at the direction of his own brother, Rezin. But the classic design came from Jim in subsequent versions that had his modifications. Jim used his brother's version in a bloody skirmish called the Sandbar Fight. Jim was nearly killed by two assailants who both shot him. One endeavored to finish him off by stabbing him with a cane sword, but the sword bent when it hit Jim's sternum, and so it gave Jim a moment to spring upon his attacker with his huge knife. He killed him instantly. He then badly wounded the second assailant, who only survived by fleeing as fast as his injuries allowed him to run. You see, in those days, you wanted to take a knife to a gunfight because guns were notoriously unreliable. Bowie miraculously survived, and the account of the Sandbar fight, thanks to a journalist who witnessed it, went viral. Jim Bowie and his knife were thus immediately immortalized. What made the knife different was its size. The original was almost a foot long, but the next model, Bowie Knife 2.0, was even longer and razor sharp on the bottom and the top. About a third of the top, the cliff point of the knife, was honed to a fine edge, so it cut both ways. Its lethality became legendary. The Red River Herald of Natchitoches, Louisiana, would one day write, no doubt hyperbolically, that after the Sandbar fight, all the steel in the country, it seemed, was being converted into Bowie knives. That's influence. When Bowie arrived at the Alamo 9 years later with his notoriety on the rise and his famous knife at his side, even Davy Crockett was impressed. He said the sight of it makes you queasy, especially before breakfast. Bowie's last stand at the Alamo elevated his fame to the level of a demigod. It was widely claimed, at least what I heard as a kid, that he took out 10 Mexican soldiers with his knife in close-quarters combat. That is improbable, given that Bowie was critically ill from typhoid fever or pneumonia at the time, but a good legend will kill probability any day of the week. Of course, no one can say for certain what happened in those last minutes, and given his reputation for cat-like reflexes mixed with the adrenaline of battle, who can say? I do like what Bowie's mama said when she learned of his death. I'll wager no wounds were found in his back, she said. After his death, the Bowie knife, in various versions, began to be made by blacksmiths from the American Southwest to Sheffield, England, where the finest ones were made and exported back to America. Texas Rangers carried them. The U.S. Marines had their own version. In popular films, Rambo never left home without his, and neither did Crocodile Dundee. It's the one he's holding when he says,
"That's a knife."
And Brad Pitt does some fancy swastika carving with his Bowie knife in Inglourious Basterds.
"I think this just might be my masterpiece."
It's as famous as the Swiss Army knife or the buck knife. Given the ubiquity of Bowie's knife in the world today, nearly 184 years after his death, I'd say Jim Bowie is a greater influencer than any social media star you can name. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
W.F.'s something of an influencer himself. He's a Fulbright scholar and professor of culture and communication at the University of Texas, RGV. You can check out more of his stories from Texas on iTunes or wherever fine podcasts are served.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton recently chimed in about those long lines during Texas primary voting. She said that Republicans got more machines than Democrats and that the lines were 7 hours long. Now, wait a minute. Is all that true? We turn now, of course, to Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about hiccups with primary voting that we've talked about here on The Standard. But the specific claims from Clinton, that was what made you want to focus in a little bit more. What specifically did she say?
Right. So Hillary Clinton made this statement during an appearance on The Tonight Show the day after Super Tuesday, which mm-hmm. I still can't believe was only last week. And she was talking about conversations that she'd had with some of the candidates running for president this time around. And she said one piece of advice that she had shared with them was to be vigilant and keep an eye out for voter suppression tactics. And then she started talking about what happened in Texas during the primary. And I believe we've got audio of that.
Or as we saw in places yesterday, particularly in Texas, you know, the Republican side gets 25 machines. The Democratic side gets 5 machines. People were literally standing in line for 7 hours.
Is she talking about the voters at Texas Southern University who we heard were there past midnight?
That's what my assumption was. As I think we all are aware at this point, the issues at Texas Southern were some of the most noticeable across the state in terms of long lines and long wait times.
And we should note that this is at an historically black university, right?
That's right, in Harris County. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely not the only place that saw these long lines. This was kind of being reported across the state. But she's right that in this case, people were in line for a crazy amount of time, some cases upwards of 7 hours. But what I'm more interested in talking with you about is her explanation for the cause of this delay.
Well, what she said specifically was that the Republican side got 25 machines. The Democratic side got 5 machines. Someone set that up wrong.
Right. And those are very specific numbers.
Yeah,
and
sure are.
One of the problems with this right off the bat is that in Texas, elections are conducted at the local level. So there's no real uniformity county by county across the 254 counties that we have. There's a lot of variables that can come into play as well when we're looking at primary elections specifically, because mm-hmm. political parties locally and at the state level work with these county election officials to kind of decide how things are going to be run. Importantly, in this case, how voting machines are actually going to be allocated
on
election
day. In a sense, this is being done for the convenience of the parties is what it gets down to.
Right. And they both have to agree on it. The election official has to sign off on it. And it's these conversations, but also an analysis of historic voting trends in that area that kind of result in how things actually happen on election day.
I ask you again, were there 25 voting machines for the Republicans and just five machines for the Democrats?
So maybe there, it depends, right? So there,
you become a lawyer now.
Different. So in Travis County, for example, Democrats and Republicans were allowed to share the same voting machines. So this wasn't a factor that came into play. Mm-hmm. In Tarrant County, this was one of the larger counties that had a different number of voting machines for Republicans and Democrats.
Okay.
In Harris County, where we saw these long lines,
right,
they decided to have an equal number of machines for Democrats and Republicans at all of the polling places.
Even in those areas where historically more Democrats had been showing up to the polls?
That's right. And that caught a lot of people's attention and came under a lot of scrutiny, especially as we were seeing the long lines there and mm-hmm. waiting for election returns.
Right.
One of the issues as well was that a lot of the voting centers were located in Republican commissioner districts in Harris County, even though that area has historically seen more Democratic voter involvement on primary days. There's also the issue of the Democratic ticket being the only one with a contested primary ballot and therefore is going to see a little more turnout than Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were confused about the decision to have an equal number of voting machines.
So I'm thinking that we might be getting close to an answer here. I mean, if you said that the party officials agreed equal number of voting machines.
Right. So Clinton was right that there were long lines on election night. But the issue here is that she really oversimplifies the factors that contributed to that. In some places, this may have been the issue, but there were so many other things going on that day. And in the county that she highlighted with the 7-hour wait time, they had an equal number of voting machines. So we rated this claim mostly false.
Mostly false, Hillary Clinton's Tonight Show claim about primary voting in Texas. That rating comes from PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman, headed up by Madeline Meckelberg. Madeline, good to see you again. Thanks so much.
Good to see you, too.
And you are listening to
The Texas Standard.
All right, let's check in once again with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, what you seeing?
Hey, David. Well, as I mentioned earlier, you posed this question yesterday, talking about the coronavirus and what would it take for people to change their travel plans. Obviously, many people's plans upended, things like South by Southwest being canceled.
Right.
So lots of uncertainty out there. So it's interesting to see the range of responses we're seeing here. I got an email to the Texas Standard inbox from a one Wes Schlenker. He mm-hmm. says, I am traveling with my wife and children to England next week over spring break. He says that he did a back of the napkin calculation of the risk of dying from COVID-19 in England, where there are some 300 cases compared to dying in a car wreck this week. He says it's roughly 3 to 10 times more likely that he would perish in a car wreck.
Hmm.
And goes on to say that it would be foolish to cancel his family trip if he considers the risk of driving an acceptable part of his vacation.
Someone literally doing the math on
this.
Yeah,
I know. Wild stuff. Via Twitter, a different perspective here from Jill Bailey. Jill reaches out to say that she already canceled a domestic flight because I worry less about my own immunity, but more so of others, like my partner who has a disability and
yeah.
is on an immunosuppressant. Also, her father who recently had heart surgery.
Right.
She says, I hope everyone is cautious for others. And I guess that kind of gets to this question, too, that we've heard posed almost similar to the vaccine issue. It's a sort of question of herd immunity and not really about young, healthy people,
mm-hmm.
Relatively healthy people getting ill, but people that may not fall into those categories.
Other folks, yeah, trying to be sensitive about some of the infirm, some of the elder folk, other people
yeah.
who may be facing some serious health issues. Notwithstanding the coronavirus.
And this ongoing question of the sort of lack of resources, lack of testing out there. Paula Whiteman on her Facebook page says that she's bracing for several more cases to be announced nationally. She says statistics here domestically are so low only because the stats indicate positives from people who have been tested. And they're making people jump through hoops just to get tested, in her words. So obviously, continuing to dominate the conversation here. We're also watching the political developments. The Trump administration set to be mulling assistance to many industries, including shale drillers active in Texas, many of whom are like really highly leveraged to get the equipment to go out there, explore in the shale for oil and gas. So we may be seeing that come. We've also heard the Trump administration mulling things like a payroll tax cut.
Yeah, right.
So obviously, this is going to continue to play out here, not just in Texas, but
even
nationally.
Talking about maybe moving the date taxes are due.
Yeah.
Now that's, we're not there yet.
No.
We have to underscore that. So y'all need to keep on track with what you got to get done by the 15th of April, at least for now.
We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at texasstandard.o/r/g. And we're going to be right back here on the wireless set tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David, along with Wells and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.